We're not talking about donating a building so that a school's more likely to take your son or daughter. We're talking about deception and fraud. Fake test scores, fake athletic credentials, fake photographs, bribed college officials.
Tonight, career fallout for actress Lori Loughlin, days after rushing back from the set of her Hallmark show to face arrest in that college admissions scandal.
USC told us in a statement that current applicants caught up in the scandal will be denied admission.
You know how conspiracy theorists say everything is rigged for the wealthy and famous? Well, as a wealthy, famous person, let me just respond by saying,
you're absolutely right.
Wealthy parents bribe counselors and coaches so unqualified students can fake their way into America's most prestigious institutions. I'm Arvin Alney. Our main topic today, the scandal in higher education as seen by veteran insiders. How did this happen? And what's the message about the value of America's elite institutions of higher learning? But first, it's only happened once before. A criminal investigation of two deadly crashes of Boeing's latest aircraft. The 737 MAX went down in Jakarta, Indonesia, and Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The U.S. finally joined other countries in grounding the plane when passengers began changing their schedules to avoid getting on board. Questions have been raised about Boeing's relationship to the Federal Aviation Administration in certifying the plane to fly with new software that pilots were not told about. Dominic Gates is aerospace reporter for the Seattle Times. He's covered Boeing since 2003. One former chief counsel of the FAA says this is the last thing you need, a criminal investigation, when the priority is to find out what happened and fix the plane.
Right. Well, the fact is, it is extremely unusual and, again, goes against all previous practice in U.S. aviation to have a criminal investigation connected with an accident. I mean, the last time this happened, it did happen once before in 1996 when the ValuJet plane went down in Florida. There was a criminal investigation because that crash was caused when the contractor who maintained those planes decided to carry oxygen generators in the cargo hold that caused a fire and brought the plane down. And there were indictments afterwards. But in general, the U.S. practice and the U.S. philosophy is very different from other countries. In other countries, you may sometimes find a pilot being charged with negligence. That doesn't happen in the United States. It hasn't happened. Because the theory is that you want people to be as open as possible with any safety concerns. You don't want them hiding things because they're afraid they're going to be charged with anything. And so there is this practice in the United States to keep things open and to have everyone free to talk, pilots, maintenance engineers, anybody else who's involved in an accident, freely talks, you find out what happened, and you fix it. You don't try to punish people and scare them. So the idea that a grand jury is now looking into this for possible, it's all very secret, of course, so we don't know exactly what they're after. But the fact that a criminal investigation is at least being looked at is really new here and quite strange.
From what you've said, it would appear the criminal investigation might get in the way of the effort to find out what went wrong and fix the plane.
Well, when a criminal investigation starts, you may get people pleading the fifth, and you may get a lot of people not willing to talk to anybody else except under oath. The FBI is involved. The local FBI office here in Seattle is involved in this investigation. That's the level that this is at. That scares people. But on the other hand, they have the power to interview people, put them under oath, and demand answers. So I don't know where this is going to go, but we now have the Department of Justice doing this criminal investigation. We have the Department of Transportation, Inspector General's office, doing an audit of the certification process of the MAX. And I think these two inquiries are unprecedented, really.
The problem has to do, as I understand it, with the MCAS, the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, as it's called, and that has something to do with software that controls the plane in a way that pilots can't override, but the pilots weren't told about it. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yes. Well, this system, which we call MCAS, it is actually just a piece of software, and it was introduced by Boeing to kick in automatically, as you say, without pilot input, in certain extreme circumstances. The scenario it's designed for is something that an airline pilot should never actually be in. It's the sort of maneuver that you might see a fighter pilot do at an air show. But in flight test, they are required during certification to do what's called a wind-up turn. And it's at the outer envelope of the performance of the airplane. And to make the plane safely handle all that and handle like the former versions of the 737 as it did so, Boeing engineers decided that they needed this extra help in the background. I think they decided that they did not need to tell the pilots because it would only kick in momentarily in this extreme situation. And you don't want to overload pilots with information that they don't need. So you only tell them what they do need to know. And anyway, that was a decision that was made. And it may now seem like a bad decision in hindsight.
So does it appear that these extreme circumstances occurred? Apparently, there is some black box recordings indicating that the pilots were trying to deal with something that they simply didn't understand. Does it appear that the system kicked in when it wasn't supposed to?
Yes, it did kick in when it wasn't supposed to. The plane wasn't in this extreme situation that the system was designed for at all. But there was a sensor on the plane there was a bad signal coming through the flight computer telling the plane that it was that its nose was way up and that it was approaching a stall. And so the system kicked in when it shouldn't have. And it, not only that, it kicked in repeatedly. So the pilot, the system pushed the nose down. The pilot, using a thumb switch on the control column, brought the nose back up again. What the system does is it swivels the horizontal tail, what's called the stabilizer, and swiveling that upwards pushes the nose down. So that's what was happening. The pilot countered that. He countered it 23 times on the Lion Air flight last October, the flight that crashed in Jakarta. He countered it 23 times before finally losing control. Every single time, the system kicked in again because of this faulty signal. It was still telling the plane, you're about to stall. Your nose is way too high. So the system kept pushing the nose down 23 times, up and down, up and down. It was a terrible roller coaster ride in the last minutes of that flight.
And some indication that that also happened in the other flight in Addis Ababa. But what about the pressure on Boeing to try to change the plane and the relationship between Boeing and the FAA? Those things have been brought up in this context.
Right. Well, again, I wrote about that on Sunday, and a lot of readers have been surprised that the work of the system safety assessment, a formal document that was a system safety analysis that was worked out as part of the certification process for this specific system, was done by Boeing. Readers have been surprised by that, but actually that's the way it's done these days and has been increasingly for some years. The FAA doesn't have the funding or the resources. It doesn't have the manpower to do all this. And for years now, they've been delegating more and more work to industry, partly because industry has been demanding it. In fact, the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018, which was passed into law in last October, just before the Lion Air crash. In there, if you look inside the act, it says there's a clause in there that tells the FAA they have to delegate as much as possible to industry, to the manufacturers, unless they can identify some good safety reason why not. And in other words, putting all the onus for, on the FAA to push things out to Boeing unless they can find some solid reason not to. So that, in fact, is the way most of it is done. The Boeing employees are, very good Boeing employees are assigned to be authorized representatives of the FAA. They do the work. They do the analysis. They work out the probabilities of failure. They decide that it meets all requirements. They send the paperwork to the FAA. FAA technical people are supposed to look at that paperwork and sign off on it. That's their role. But as my story pointed out, when the MAX was being certified, managers within the FAA were putting a lot of pressure on the technical people to speed the process.
All right. In the meantime, of course, 350 people have died, and a criminal investigation, almost unprecedented, is underway. Dominic Gates with the Seattle Times, thank you so much.
All right, Warren, thank you.
Now, the scandal in higher education. It's an ugly scandal. Admission to the so-called college elite is not just unfair and discriminatory, it's a vehicle for outright fraud, with the children of wealthy parents, including celebrities, masquerading as athletes in sports they don't even play. Their portraits sometimes photoshopped into pictures of those who really participate. Admissions officers and coaches taking big money to perpetrate these and other deceptions. Sometimes the students are in on the scam, and sometimes they're kept in the dark. John Ryder was an admissions officer at Stanford University, one of the institutions most deeply involved. He had that job from 1985 until the year 2000. Welcome to The Point.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
How did this happen?
It happened because there's a surprising amount of trust in the whole admissions world. The colleges trust the guidance counselors and the teachers at the high schools who write the letters of recommendation. And they certainly trust their own employees, their own coaches. And in case of one school, USC, there was an athletic department administrator who was involved. When I've talked to people that I worked with, they said, I can't believe that so-and-so, you know, they would name a coach, like the former sailing coach, not the current one that was fired, but the previous one, the person that worked in athletics said he was an angel. He never would have done anything like this. So I think that there was so much trust involved and there was a vulnerability. And this guy Singer figured it out. And no one asked me how he found these coaches and knew who he could turn. But that was what happened. And of course, now, very sadly, that trust is going to go away. The colleges are going to check and double check. Well, they should, to make sure that so-called crew coxswain has actually been in the side of a boat.
Well, was the trust really justified in the first place, or has the vulnerability always been there because, in fact, this and other kinds of deceptions have been going on for a long time?
There have indeed. You're absolutely right. And when I worked at Stanford, again, a long time ago, we would catch them every once in a while. There would be one every 2 years, and maybe there were some we didn't catch.
Did you know this guy, Rick Singer?
I've never met him. I had heard of him. About 20 years ago, I got called by somebody in Sacramento who was a volunteer at a high school who heard him speak. Apparently, he's very flashy, very charismatic, very poised. And he was bragging about his connections to Stanford, how he had a kind of, I don't know whether you call it a back door or a side door, but he knew people at Stanford of influence. And he mentioned two of them at that presentation. And there were two people I knew. Both are very well connected to Stanford and very visible in the public eye. Not that, you know, everybody would know who they were, but if you knew Stanford, you would know these people. And I contacted both of them and said, you don't want anything to do with this guy. This guy is sleazy, and I don't know how he thinks he knows you, but you don't want to know him. And they both insisted, Singer, I understand, that he no longer used their names in public. But so he's been around a long time, but what's different about this is around 2011, he moved to LA and Newport Beach, and he went beyond just bragging and into bribing, and that's bad.
Okay, so this current situation obviously is a well-organized criminal enterprise with a lot of important people and a lot of famous people involved in it. But there's nothing new, it would seem to me, from what you've said about people trying to get in to important colleges such as Stanford, where you were an admissions officer for reasons that weren't on the up and up. Let me introduce Tim Klein. He's Director of Strategic Partnerships for Project Wayfinder. He's also a clinical therapist and an award-winning guidance counselor. Tim Klein, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is Wayfinder?
Project Wayfinder is we are a nonprofit purpose learning program. So we partner with high schools and colleges to help students figure out how to navigate their lives to make them meaningful and fulfilling.
Okay, purpose learning. How does purpose learning compare or contrast to getting into a name school?
Yeah, and I think purpose learning, which I'm happy to talk about, there's a lot of really promising research about the positive impact it can have on students. I actually think purpose learning is getting more and more momentum behind it as a response to the education system that we're in. And so I really see this college admissions scandal not as a problem, but of a symptom of a larger problem. And I've just noticed throughout my career working with a whole host of high school students that I've realized that over the last 40 years, the number one objective of education in this country in high school has been college prep. And that's either explicitly said by schools and they name their schools college prep, or it's implicitly implied that the reason you are going to work hard in our school is to go to college. And so what we've noticed is that high schools are really focused on what they want to do. They want to get their kids into the best colleges. They're really focusing on how they're going to do it. They're going to offer AP courses. They're going to offer SAT prep. They're going to offer community service opportunities. But they've overlooked this incredibly important question, which is, why should students want to go to college? And I think what's happened is that we've equated going to college with success, but we actually haven't define success for students. And what's happened is that we now define success as status and prestige and wealth and power. And as a result, we are saying you should get into these elite colleges because they will give you status and prestige. And as a result, that will lead to power and wealth.
What's wrong with that?
Great question. So what's wrong with that is that there's really compelling research by Tim Kasser out of Knox College. And he's found that when people prioritize what he calls extrinsic core values, which are status, prestige, power, and wealth, when the more people prioritize these things, the less day-to-day happiness they have, the higher levels of depression and anxiety, the shorter meaningful relationships they have in their lives. And it brings out the worst in people. So his research has found that when people prioritize these extrinsic core values, they are more likely to pollute, they're less likely to vote, they're more likely to hold racist and prejudiced ideologies, and they are more likely to cheat, which is what we're seeing here with this college cheating scandal. So I think the bigger problem we're seeing here is that we've created a system that incentivizes people to prioritize values that not only harm mental health, but bring out the worst human behaviors.
So you think the system itself actually encourages then the kind of thing that we have seen and have been so shocked by?
Absolutely. I mean, it's literally the number one reason to go to school is to go to college. But so when I was working with students, I would do college counseling with them and I would ask them, tell me about college. What do you know about it? Why do you want to go? And I've been working with low-income first-gen students. I've worked with undocumented students. I've worked with incredibly hardworking students who go on to Harvard. And when I'm working with them in their senior year of high school, oftentimes I am the first person who's asking them, why do they want to go to college? Or what do they want for themselves? What are their aspirations for the future? What problems do they want to solve? So it's like the system, we are not giving students the space to figure out how do they want to define success for themselves.
Actually, if I can join in here for a second.
John Ryder, formerly at Stanford. Go ahead.
When I worked at my high school, when I first met with the students, middle of the junior year, and I had a 6-page questionnaire, and one of the questions was, how do you define success other than getting into college? In other words, an implicit way of saying exactly what Tim's talking about. Why do you want to go to college? Because you may realize this, the word prestige has an interesting history, etymology. It comes from the French word meaning deceit, meaning trickery, meaning illusion. And of course, we don't treat it that way. We treat it as if something's real, but it's not real. And Tim's absolutely right. And I always ask students why they want to go to college. And I was frustrated because they didn't know. And they were at a very high-powered, expensive, hardworking high school, but they were just shoving it in the slot every day. And it's very sad. And I agree 100% with what Tim was saying.
Well, wait a minute. Whatever happened to prestige in the sense that it's a good thing? Is that not the case then? Is Stanford really not a prestigious institution?
It is prestigious. Factually, people accord it prestige. I think you can get a really good education there if you know how to go about it. But just getting in doesn't mean you're gonna do that. I think it's what you do there that makes a difference, not the fact of getting in. Frank Bruni had a wonderful piece in the Sunday Times about how he was teaching at Princeton, and he had to accept these kids into his seminar, and they submitted better work for his to apply to his seminar than they did once they were in it. That the goal was just to get in. So I think it's an illusion, and I make fun of it. I mock it, and I have a long list on my desk, which I show kids, of really well-known, quote, successful people who went to colleges that aren't particularly fancy and people wouldn't particularly know about. Most obvious example is Steven Spielberg went to Cal State Long Beach, but there's bunches of those, dozens and dozens. You don't have to go to Stanford or Harvard to make something out of your life. Just don't.
I think what John's getting at here.
Here's Tim Klein again with Project Wayfinder. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's making the point here that we live in a society where we assume that colleges make students successful. But when you look at the research, what's actually happening is that successful students are going to colleges. So we've got it backwards. And so what's happening here is that in our research, we're finding in the research on youth purpose is that purpose is defined by Bill Damon out of Stanford University, which is just a funny irony given this conversation.
But a very good guy.
Yes. Fantastic pioneer in the field. And he's found that when students have a long-term intention that's both personally meaningful and it benefits the world beyond the self, and when that goal is education dependent, meaning when students can see how doing well in school is a stepping stone to pursuing those purposeful aspirations, those students they're more intrinsically motivated, they have higher levels of self-regulation, they're psychologically more resilient, they're more engaged in school, they're more likely to go to college, and they're more likely to graduate college and be thriving in their lives. So essentially, this sense of purpose is correlated with every indicator of well-being out there. And what's happening is that students who found their purpose and tied it to school are more successful, and they're self-selecting into these institutions. So these institutions are really collecting purposeful students, and many of the times, these purposeful students are going to be successful regardless of the school that they go to. And to me, the most heartbreaking part of this whole admission scandal is that when you look at research, so a lot of these students who were gaining admissions to these schools didn't have a sense of purpose, were not intrinsically motivated, and so they are not going to be successful just because they're attending these schools. And that data plays out for a lot of students. When you are not intrinsically motivated to be successful, going to college isn't going to make you successful. But the research shows that going to an elite institution benefits a very specific subset of students, and that is marginalized students and historically underrepresented students like students of color, low-income students, first-gen students. And to me, what is heartbreaking about this is that these students who weren't going to benefit from going to Stanford, USC, and these other schools were taking a seat away from a far more deserving student who was going to get real benefits from going there.
Let me ask you a question, and I'll first take a very brief break, but I want our listeners to know what I'm going to ask you when we come back, and that is, how do you get a student, a 17-year-old boy or girl or whoever, to be purposeful. How do they get to be purposeful in that length of time? I'm talking with John Ryder of Stanford University, formerly of Stanford University, Tim Klein with Project Wayfinder. This is To The Point. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, only back with To The Point, once again talking about the college scandal, so much of which has been aired for so long now on every single news medium that we have in this country and elsewhere. Talking with John Ryder, formerly the admissions officer at Stanford University, and Tim Klein at Project Wayfinder. So let me ask you both that question. You want to have a purposeful student, but how do you get one? What do you do when your kid says, why do you want to go to college? The kid says, I don't know. So the answer then is, well, go to college and find out. John Ryder, let me ask you that first.
Well, that sometimes happens, that they go off without purpose, and maybe they take a class and the professor is exciting and interesting and they find something that suddenly matters to them. But you've hit on it, Warren. It's the big mystery. It is clear that group reinforcement helps, that if you have a bunch of kids and you can get them together and talk about this, they can work through it. But I found it one of my most frustrating activities as a counselor to you can't just force feed it. It's not, they have you, the old cliche of you can take a horse to the trough, but you can't force them to drink. And you can't give a kid purpose. It just happens. Clearly, it can be modeled by parents. I think parents can be very valuable in doing things. I like one of the phrases that Tim used a moment ago, and I completely endorse it, about doing something that matters to other people. That's why community service can be great, not because colleges want it, and they do and they don't. It's not essential. And I've seen kids do community service in a meaningless way, where they're just doing it to save up the hours. And I've seen people do it in a way that is really heartfelt, and they know they're making a difference. Adding to the world makes people feel good. And Tim's right about that. Maybe he's got the secret potion. I'm waiting to hear what he'll say.
Well, let's hear it. Tim Klein, go ahead with Project Wayfinder. What about it?
Oh, well, you're too kind. I appreciate that, John. But so I'm excited about this work because this idea of purpose, it's a relatively new field. They've only been really intensive research for about 16 to 17 years. And then a lot of the research is showing that purposeful students are doing better, but you're right. I think John was saying it there, right, that most students don't have a sense of purpose that's connected to school. And Bill Damon's research says that only 1 in 5 high school students really are actively pursuing a purposeful goal. And so where we're at in the field is it's an open question about how do you intentionally cultivate purpose in students. And we actually think that should be that question of how do you cultivate purpose in students needs to be the primary objective of every single education. And so the way we're doing it at Wayfinder is we ask students questions about it. Because the thing about purpose is that it's internal. It comes from within. Someone else, like John said, can't give it to you. And so we need to create space within schools where students are asking themselves, what are my intrinsic core values? What do I care about? What are the strengths that make me feel like my best self? What are the skills that I want to be developing and learning and mastering? And then also, what positive impact do I want to make on the world? And what problems have I experienced that I want to solve? What are the challenges that I'm seeing that is making it difficult for me and my family and society to succeed in? And it's these questions that are going to provide the clues for purpose. And so we need to start leading, we need to start creating spaces for students to explore these questions for themselves. And then once they start identifying these things, then the conversation is, how can college be a potential path for you in pursuing these purposeful pursuits? So to me, the big thing here is college cannot be the end goal in and of itself. We need to go beyond that. We need to start asking students, great, you want to go to USC? okay, imagine you go to USC, what happens next? What do you hope happens after that? And we need to start asking these deeper, more meaningful questions and not treating college like an end goal.
John Ryder, let me go back to you again. You were Stanford admissions officer between 1985 and 2000. The so-called elite colleges are getting very, very expensive. To what extent do these rankings that come out in U.S. News and World Report and elsewhere reflect not so much the fact that the colleges will deliver a great education or make people better citizens, but rather because they need that kind of prestige in order to get people to donate libraries and new gyms and the other kinds of things that they can include in their costs that they pass on to the students? After all, they are tax-free businesses.
Yeah, I'm a longtime opponent of all rankings. I think they're really most meaningless and in many cases destructive. I have debated Bob Morse, who's done the rankings for 30 years at U.S. News. He's a really bright guy, and he and I agree on practically nothing. On the other hand, the rankings are a symptom. These colleges had prestige before the rankings. The rankings came out in 1984, 85 for the first time, and I think they're just part of the background static, the background noise now. Although there are plenty of cases where colleges will do certain things to boost their rankings. I once asked Morse, I said, when you look back on your own education, what gave you the most value? What was the most important thing about your education? And I can ask this of you or Tim or anybody else, and everybody gives pretty much the same answer. It was good teaching. If you had a good teacher or more than one good teacher, as I did, I was lucky, who inspired me and got me to want to be a scholar and taught me that knowledge was worth having. That's fantastic. U.S. News and all of those organizations do not evaluate teaching. I asked Morse this, and he said, well, it's too hard to measure. Well, you as a student in the class measure it. You measure it in terms of your own experience. What's interesting is that there is a survey taken every year called the Survey of Student Engagement. It's done at Indiana University, and lots of colleges participated. And it measures how much the kids are, quote, engaged in their college experience, which is not the only useful measure, but it would be a useful one. And it's not publicized. The colleges don't want to let it out. And I'll tell you why they don't want to let it out, because I think the most engagement is at the smaller liberal arts colleges with small classes and faculty who are devoted to teaching and care about their students and can get to know their names and care about their progress and stay in touch with them. I think these small, often unprestigious colleges are fantastic. And they give the greatest value, but, you know, they don't have that name.
Let me go back to Tim Klein and ask a little bit more. Not only are you with Project Wayfinder, but you're a curriculum design specialist at Boston College and a teaching fellow at Harvard University, certainly one of the very top, if not always the top, of the elitist colleges. What about that? Are students engaged at Harvard, or is that something that Harvard would rather not publicize?
You're going to get me in trouble here. But so I'm in the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, and so I'm working with future educators who thankfully, and social workers and school administrators who are thankfully, inherently they're coming for a very purposeful reason. So they're actively engaged because they're self-selecting in there. But I think John has it 100% right, where we do not have good metrics to define effectiveness in school. And I did not know that they didn't release engagement numbers in school, but I'm not surprised because on the high school end, they do release engagement numbers. And so Gallup has been doing really interesting student survey data about student engagement. And they're finding that student disengagement for the last 7 years has risen every single year. And we are at a place in our education now where 51% of high school students are disengaged in school. And to me, that is a symptom of this problem that, as you talked about, as tuitions continue to rise astronomically, and it becomes harder and harder to get into these schools, and we're not telling kids what the true values of these schools are, they are deciding it's just not worth it, and they're disengaging from school. And what I'm seeing on the college end, in college in general, is that John, again, is spot on in the true value in education is building meaningful relationships. And the Strata Institute is showing that students are struggling on that end too. So they, in these surveys, they found that only 1 in 3 students say that they have developed a meaningful relationship with their professors. And that is a problem because that is directly correlated to their ability to be successful once they leave college. So again, we have to, as John was really nicely articulating, get beyond just getting into college and what is the true value of college and how can we evaluate schools' effectiveness on a more nuanced level.
So, John Ryder, is the real reason for going to one of these elite schools that you are, as Tim Klein suggested, anointed? You've got the status, the prestige, the wealth, and the power, or you're likely to get it.
Yeah, the word anointment is a good word, and I've seen it used a couple of times this week in the media. It's a religious term. You go to church and you get anointed by the clergy person with oil, and it brings you into a holier space. This is for those who believe that. I'm not questioning whether it's true or not. It's just what people believe. If you're a wealthy person, like many of the people involved in this scandal, and you've got a lot of money, you can buy your kids a Porsche. You can buy fancy skis. You can get a ski house. You can take fancy trips. You can do stuff, and people will look at you and say, oh, that person's got a lot of money. That's a rich person. It doesn't have to do with quality. What the college process has done is it anoints people with an aura, because people believe that it was honest. It anoints them with an aura of something greater, of intelligence, of service, of value. You're assumed because you go, oh, your kid goes to X. Oh, that is something special. They must have earned it. And that gives people a great sense of satisfaction. I think that is underlying psychologically this whole business. I don't think it has to do with the alumni network. I don't think it has to do with getting a job. The children of rich people are going to get jobs anyway. They always do. Tim's right that going to the – look at – I mean, he's a whipping boy for this. But look at Jared Kushner, right, at Harvard. His dad gave him $2 million. And he goes to Harvard, and he goes to work for his dad. It didn't matter. Jared Kushner could have gone anywhere, and he would still be Jared Kushner. So and it's probably a bad example. But anyway, those kinds of people are going to be successful. And so it's this extra kind of sanctification that goes behind it. They're looking for that magic so they can feel they were a good parent, so they can brag at the country club or even the grocery store. It's very, very sad because the kid's getting the idea that, oh, you don't really believe in me. You don't really think I'm a good person. I'm just here in order to enhance you, to make you a better person, you know, because you're a good parent. I think that's very, very sad.
So, Tim Klein, how do you find one of these smaller, less prestigious institutions that does, in fact, welcome and help those who are purposeful? How do you do that? That's not listed in U.S. News and World Report.
Well, so it's incredibly difficult because what you're talking about is that students don't have a decision-making framework to make this decision. So what you're talking about is when we ask students, what college do you want to go to? There's over 4,000 colleges in the United States. And so that is an incredibly impossible question to answer. And students don't know what they should be looking for when picking a college that's a good fit for them. And so as a response, as John was saying, we do virtue signaling, where we want to pick the school that's hardest to get into because it's going to signal something about us. Or we're going to pick a school that has the nicest facilities. And so because students are assuming if it has really, really nice facilities, it must be a good school. And so I think what we need to do is at Project Wayfinder, we have curriculum where we have students identify these core components of purpose, like their core values, strengths, skills, and impact. And then we use that as a decision-making tool to figure out what colleges they should apply to. So once they identify their own core values, let's go look at these small liberal arts schools and let's look at their core values. So if we're working with a student who really cares about social justice or community service, a great example of that is Union College in upstate New York. They have every single student has to do a community service project baked into their curriculum. So right there, they can see a core value alignment. And I think instead of just doing name brand, because when I think John really is doing a great job of attacking this myth and showing it and exposing it, is that yes, there is some value in the name brand of a school, but essentially it's one bullet point on a resume. And it might get you in the door for an interview for a job that you normally wouldn't otherwise. But once that person in that job interview looks at that bullet point, what they're really going to focus on are all the experiences that come after that. And so if students aren't taking advantage of building relationships with professors, taking advantage of internships and unique experiences and projects, and learning specific knowledge and skills, yeah, they'll get the interview, but they're never going to get hired for these jobs because they didn't take advantage of the resources at the college.
So, John Ryder, question, whether you're at Stanford or Harvard or one of the others, are we arguing here that they're really not as good as they're cracked up to be? Or are there, in fact, real benefits that you can get, not just in terms of wealth, power, prestige, and so on, but rather in terms of a good education?
Well, of course you can get a good education. I'd be surprised. It's not that they're not as good as they're cracked up to be. I would say that there are many other colleges. Tim just mentioned Union College. I could rattle them off. I could spend here all day. These small liberal arts colleges where you get equivalent kinds of care.
Rattle them off. Let's hear.
All right. Well, in your area in L.A., how about Occidental College? How about Pitzer College? Pitzer actually out in Claremont, they actually ask on their application about your core values. I would imagine that Tim likes Pitzer because everybody is concerned about social justice in different ways. How about, and by the way, these are mentioned. U.S. News has all these liberal arts colleges. They've just got a different listing from the big research universities. There's also a wonderful book that's in its third edition. It's called Colleges That Change Lives. Just think about that title, that you could go to college and it would change your life. And it profiles about 40 colleges around the country. A few of them are in California on the West Coast, but not very many. St. Mary's in Northern California is in there, but Whitman College up in Washington. Tim mentioned some research done by a professor at Knox College. Knox College is in Galesburg, Illinois. Wonderful college. So there are all these schools out there. You just got to go do a little digging. And what frustrates me is when I talk to families that, well, we're going to go east and we're going to go to Harvard and Brown and Columbia and Princeton. And I say, well, what about Lafayette? What about Vassar? What about Colgate? I'm always throwing, what about Middlebury? Some of them are hard to get into. Middlebury is pretty hard to get into. But in terms of a community where you know people and everybody, yeah, they play sports, but they have, you can't be a dumb jock at a place like Middlebury. You have to be a good, successful student. I know this because I had student athletes from my high school that went there. So there's hundreds of these really fine colleges. And here's the dirty little secret. Many of them are not that crazy hard to get into. You can still get into them. They're still doing admissions, not denials. But of course, that gets us into the paradox, because the paradox is for the scandal is that the only value in a college is that it's hard to get into. And it reminds me of Groucho Marx's famous remark that he would never join a country club that would take him as a member, because the idea being if they would take him, Groucho — I thought Groucho was very funny, I liked him — but if it would take Groucho, they would take almost anybody. And therefore, what's the point of going to a country club if you're not shutting people out? So it's a little more subtle with the colleges, but people don't want to go to a college because it's too easy to get into. And I say, great. You don't have to go through all the craziness. Don't go through all the craziness of the admissions process. Just go. You have to take the test, although it's a lot of times optional now. And
might be cheaper, too.
And it might be cheaper. Some of them give give merit scholarships. I have mixed feelings about that, but that's okay. We'll leave that for another day.
I want to take it one step further than that. Is one, we need to ask ourselves, what is the value of going to college? And to me, we're at this place in the conversation where is the value of college going to increase your earning potential and increase your access to meaningful career? Or is it to learn critical knowledge and to be a more engaged citizen? And those are two very, very different questions we need to be considering. And we need to be asking our students what is important to them. And we're seeing this trend as the economy is getting more, as technology is making it, disrupting labor markets, and it's making harder to find stable, meaningful work, that 85% of students coming into college, they say the number one priority is to find meaningful work afterwards. And so if that's what we're talking about, I'm going to go a step further and say, in here in Massachusetts, where I am right now, if that's the number one objective for students, they should consider going to Bunker Hill Community College, which doesn't have an acceptance rate. Because you can go to Bunker Hill Community College, and they have a partnership with a local energy company where you will get trained to work for that energy company, and you're going to be coming out with a salary that is on average of coming, it's a salary of around $60,000 a year, where if you look at the data from MIT and Harvard, it's on pace with the average salary of MIT and Harvard grads 10 years after they graduate from college. So if we are defining success of college by your ability to find meaningful work, we need to start looking at very, very different statistics, and we need to be a lot more open-minded about it. Because I don't think anyone would compare Bunker Hill Community College to MIT or Harvard, but when you're looking at it through earning potential, they can be just as effective.
Let me ask you both, what do you think is the principal lesson that we have learned from this extraordinary scandal? John Ryder, formerly at Stanford, you go first.
All right, we're still learning. New stuff is coming out every day. Who knows how much more there is. I think the principal lesson that we've learned is no systems are perfect, that a scoundrel is born every minute. Sometimes they get away with it, sometimes they don't, but that it's important for our inner mental health, here Tim and I are very strongly in alignment, to do the right thing, to be moral, and that you live a better life that way. But it's not easy. The world is always offering us temptations and shortcuts and easy way around thing. And so to be an honorable person is sometimes challenging, is sometimes difficult, but that's what we have to do. Go for it.
Tim Klein?
I think this is a huge opportunity to reframe the narrative about what is the purpose of education and what role does college play with it. And I really see us needing to be saying the number one goal is to help students understand their own sense of purpose. And then as parents and educators and mentors and as institutions, our goal is to figure out how can we help connect those students to resources that's going to help them pursue that sense of purpose. And so to me, it's really stripping down this idea that college is an end in of itself. And we need to start thinking beyond college, because clearly the system is broken and it's doing real harm to a lot of students. And so we need to start having conversations about what is the definition of success for our students and what role does college play in that definition of success.
Two critical thinkers about a very important issue, illustrated by the ugly scandal that we have seen over the past couple of weeks. Tim Klein, again, with Project Wayfinder, dedicated to purpose-based education. He is a curriculum design specialist at Boston College, teaching fellow at Harvard. And John Ryder, former Stanford admissions officer at Stanford University, 1985 to 2000. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Chris Wotherspoon contributed audio assistance. Chuck Prevetary was our engineer. I'm Armin Alney. When you subscribe to our podcast, make sure to leave a review. And you can tweet your comments at tothepoint_KCRW. I'll be glad to get your message at warren.olney@kcrw.com. Keep listening. Stay in touch. We want to know what you're thinking.